The first order of business today will be Senate Bill 1227. Senator Timms, Senator Bill Brock, it's all yours. We'll start with you.
And Deuce was supposed to be here, but
okay,
we have a U.S. Senator with me in the state senator.
Anytime.
Here.
I've done this with me.
Should we wait for her?
Well, that's a powerful lady, I think.
Yes, she is a powerful lady. Yeah. Well, she'll get her chance. She'll be here shortly, I'm sure. So,
Mr. President, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
All the way, can I make a comment?
Absolutely.
It's always been delighted to see my good friend, Senator, Mr. Secretary, and all these titles he's had to his career. But I always say in my years in education, when he was the Secretary of Labor, my colleague, Philip, she said, well, you say, thank goodness for Bill Brock.
Yeah, okay.
That's the closest thing to a Secretary of Education we have, because we certainly didn't think the one who had the title at that time dealt with education, and he was the real education leader at the time. He really was. And Bill Bennett was the Secretary of Ed and did nothing for us, and Bill Brock was really moving forward with education kinds of programs through the labor Department of Labor, so it was really a treat to work with him. He had just great respect around the country from my colleagues in education.
You're very kind, Senator. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. And I'll pass your comments on to Bill Bennett, too.
Yeah, I think he's...
I heard Rickham say, Senator Duke, you're saved.
You've heard the Senator.
Yeah, right. And, you know, we do believe what Senator Duncan says, contrary to what some might say, when he speaks on education at any level, we listen, we pay attention.
No, you don't do anything. But
so, Senator Duke, Brock, and Timms, please identify yourself and proceed.
Can I start off, please?
Oh, Senator, sure.
Duke, and Senator Brock.
You started all this.
Yes, I did. And I would like to thank, first, thank you for hearing the bill. Chairman Hartung and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gene Kim, State Senator from District Number 30. I first got involved in this because Brady Adams, who's President of the Senate, and he invited Senator Brock to speak to the Oregon Senate. And he talked about accountability in education, about dropouts, about a system to find the learning defects of children to make them better students, to make their teachers better teachers because they're more thrilled when their students do better, their parents more involved in the process because they're thrilled when their children do better. I proposed a bill, and Senator Hartung heard that bill. Probably in my 16 years, without a doubt, not probably, in the Oregon Senate, you could hear a pin drop in that hearing room for around 2 hours. Everyone there, or just about everyone there, and I won't tell you the one that wasn't enthused with the program, but they were all very enthusiastic. We did manage to get it funded last session. It wasn't easy. Won't be this session either. The program, the structures of intellect program, because it wasn't put in place sooner, I really believe the ODE, Department of Education, could have done a better job than they did. But we did get it started, but it needs more time in the system to actually show the results. I have talked to Senator Brock about moving possibly more to the dropout area and enlarging the sum so we could get to the dropout problem and the learning defects that all of us have, as you found out through the testing that you've gone through, that all of us have in this process. It's exciting, especially with the question in education that we have today, for me, because I think we need accountability, and this system will bring us that. And it's been a privilege to be involved in it. Along comes Senator Dukes. That's her heart, and she mentions her enthusiasm of the program, which I said, well, why don't you introduce the bill? And or maybe she asked me.
No, you asked me.
And I think that's great. I think the more people that get involved in the SO structure of intellect program, in the education arena, we'll get enthusiastic and we'll make it happen. And I hope to be able to help you do that, being co-chair away from me. I'm not guaranteeing anything can happen in regards to this bill, but it has a priority and it's my number one priority in this legislative session. So with that, I'll shut up and let the experts talk.
Thank you for talking, not for shutting up, but thank you. Either one of you may.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Joan Duke, state senator from District 1, and I'm definitely not an expert in this. And when Senator Timms brought that bill to the floor 2 years ago, I went back and started asking him questions after he gave his carrying speech, because I just didn't get it. And I didn't see why we were going to take education money and put it into a program like this. And he had a staff person who talked to me, and finally they just said, trust us, it's a really good program. So I voted for it. And I was still grumpy about it. And then I forgot about it completely. And this January, I was at a conference in Arizona. And one day we had lunch, and we had a luncheon speaker, and it turned out to be Senator Brock. And when the speech was over, I went up to him and said, how can I get this in my school district? Imagine, look at the spectrum of kids that you see in any classroom. Imagine being able to find out how every one of those children learns. And then teach them in a method that enables them to learn. That is the simple basis for all of this. And behind it, there's a whole lot of scientific stuff that I only vaguely understand. It works. It has worked for 50 years. And we're now finally able to enjoy it in some of the school districts in Oregon. I hope that someday we'll enjoy it in all of the school districts in Oregon. But the moment we have it in 19 schools, and we're being handed out packets of a variety of things. We've gotten unsolicited letters from people in school districts where it's working. There's one letter in there from a woman that it gave me goosebumps when I read it. She's talking about her daughter. It's actually in my district, too. Her daughter, who has serious visual problems, but you can't pick them up by going to the optometrist. She'd already done the vision test at school. They thought her vision was fine. She was held back in school because she was having difficulty learning to read, and I forget what grade she is now. It's not very advanced. She's probably third or fourth grade. And at the end, the mother says that she's getting treatment in Portland. They found out what's going on. She's learning to read. And the mother says she wouldn't have had to be held back a year in school if we had had SOI earlier. And I even sitting here now, I still get shivers. Imagine what an impact, what a change you can have in kids' lives. And all we're asking to do is to find out how they learn. I'm a parent of I remember sitting in the classroom with a teacher trying to figure out why my son, who had been tested reading above high school level in about the fifth grade, was getting a D in reading. And the teacher explained, I said, you know that he's reading comprehension. She said, yes, but he's not turning in his workbook pages. I gave up at that point on that one and waited till the next year. Nobody knew at that point that he couldn't deal with workbooks. You know, later on we found that out and we found ways to work around it. But what a change it would have been for him, how much more he could have learned in that year of school had we known earlier what kind of a learner he was. And then to be able to build up somebody's learning skills the same way you would go to a weight room to build up your muscles. I mean, that we can actually do those things. So we can change kids' lives in the first grade. That we can take kids, and we know that our prisons are full of kids with learning disabilities. We didn't figure out how to teach them. We didn't know how they learned. So imagine if they're in grade school, junior high school, and we can stop them, we can teach them and get them excited about learning before they get disenchanted with the process, before they get so frustrated and feeling inadequate and down on themselves and drop out. So that's the sort of thing that's gotten me very excited about it. I came back to Oregon and said, well, let me go into the professional realm. They've got it. Surely they'll pull coals with this. I kept looking for what was wrong with it. Quite honestly, I haven't found it yet. The only criticism I hear is that there isn't research that's come down on this. And I will tell you, for all the people that I've talked to who are using this, they're in the classroom. They don't have an inclination to be going out doing research papers. They're busy working with the kids. It's worked in state after state. It's worked with companies as well as schools. We're using it in a correctional facility here in Oregon. the results are great. And all we're asking at this point, unless Senator Kims can come up with even more money, is to continue the project, the pilot, for another 2 years so that we can have enough statistics to show.
Thank you, Senator. We'll hear from Senator Brock, and then we'll get questions and comments from the committee.
Well, first, I have to thank you for letting me come again and pay my respects. I have absolutely no way I can improve on what's been said. And Gene Timms and Dukes speak with the eloquence that they do. It's hard to add anything. I find it difficult to understand why it's difficult to understand this. It makes such intuitive good sense to me as a parent that when a child is hurting, to find out why they're hurting and fix it. I can't imagine not doing that. That promise does. That's a simple statement. What we do is put a lab in a school with a trained person to run it. So the minute a child is struggling for any reason, and all these symptoms vary all over the lot, they can be hyperactive, they can be the class joker, they cannot be able to get their homework in, they cannot show up on time, they can do 50 different things to drive a teacher and their classmates crazy. But you know they're struggling, and every teacher knows it the minute they're in school. In most schools in America today, the first step is to say, will you behave? Will you sit down and shut up? Will you do your homework? Will you work harder? Will you come on and get with the program? Because they don't have the tools to find out what's making that child act the way they're acting. If you put the Bridges system in and you have a place where that teacher has identified that child as struggling, she can sit them down and say, find out for me why, and you measure 26 different mental competencies. You measure 11 different aspects of the basal central system. Now, if your aspect is system of vision, then you can find out what's making them act that way or be unable to do what they're being asked to do. And then you provide a treatment plan that says this will remedy your problem. And for the overwhelming majority of kids, it does. We can't solve every kid's problem. There are plenty of kids who have problems well beyond us. But we are, as those parents have noted, we're in over 15 states. We will have 100,000 children in the schools where we serve for them by September. That's a three-year-old program. There are a number of districts now that require kids to be put through our assessment before they're given the IEP. Because if we can find out first why they're struggling, before we start pulling more tutors out, we can fix the problem, and it may be the tutors aren't the answer. So it really does seem to make intuitive sense to me to do what a parent does, and that's to back on. I'll beat up on the kid, and I did on mine. And, you know, everyone I was as a parent knows our children have to be smart because they're our kids. And so we say, I know he's smart, so therefore he's not trying. Well, I had two sons that were trying, but they struggled every day. I have two others that were terrific. I think if we can make this system available to the kids in those countries, or a comparable system that says, first, diagnose the problem, and second, fix the problem, and then you can start putting standards on your teachers, then you can start saying, this is the achievement level we want you to make, to meet. Then you've done the first thing first. You've built the foundation of the house before you start putting the roof on. Then you're doing the right thing the right way. That's what we're asking. Basically, we're going to introduce Bill 2 years to demonstrate this program over a period of time. Last point I'd like to make, well, we do have lots of data to back it up, but most of the data is in a clinical setting. It has not been in public schools until the last three years. Well, a few schools before that, but mostly this has been work in clinics. So the research will have to come from the experience of putting in the skills like your and look at that. And that's what you put aside as an argument at the university to follow. The last quick point. Please, please, please don't ever expect this to produce results overnight. This is not a quick fix. We're working with children's minds. Going to be able to develop those mental muscles any faster than they could develop their physical muscles. It takes time to create an athlete, mental or physical. It takes time to do this. Your first consequence will be changes in handwriting, then you'll see some changes in behavior, then you'll see its abilities to pay attention, then you'll see them be able to stay on task, and probably it won't even be to the second year that you'll see real gains in achievement, because they have to develop these cards. And use it over a period of time. That's why we've asked for a 3-year demonstration to give you the opportunity to evaluate this as honestly as you have to do in your public responsibility. We're excited about being in Oregon. Since you've taken the first step, you're the first step to do it. Three other states have begun statewide demonstrations, like this, Florida, Tennessee, and West Virginia. So we're excited about that too. But I thank you for the chance to be with you. If you have questions, I'd be pleased to respond.
I might mention that two of the members are absent today, and so it's a real tribute to the three of you that there's this many of us here at 1 o'clock on a sunny Friday afternoon, the best spring day we've had, and Senator Courtney is chairing the Judiciary Committee today. Why he's not here, Senator Bryan is out of state, and we allowed Gary George to go home and farm because we've had such a cold, wet spring. He is way behind, but otherwise, yeah, they would have been here, and I thank you for coming. Questions or comments?
At least he said Mr. Chair is going to be in the field, not could
yeah.
the golf course.
Yeah,
well, he really is.
He's out in the fresh air, anyway. Any questions or comments?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordon.
Just a comment. I would like to say that after taking the structures of intellect evaluation myself a couple of weeks ago and becoming more familiar with the program in that way, I'm convinced that this is a direction that we should move in, that we should embrace. And I feel so strongly about it that I would like to have my name with the sponsors, co-sponsors' permission added to the bill.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Can I make a comment?
Certainly, whatever you want.
I talked to Senator Brock, and it would be, I think, apropos that this committee discuss this a little, that we go into the dropout area and determine from the schools, most of the teachers can tell you, who the problem children are. So you go to the problem children, and that way we get better results because we're dealing with the at-risk children, and also we can expand the system dramatically with the amount of money that we put into it. What I'm running into is Co-Chair Wade means is that we have too many pilots on the state. We keep developing pilots, but we never get any consistency in what we're doing. And you probably say, well, we shouldn't be doing this with this program. Well, my thinking is, and I was a member of education when I first came to this body, as the most innovative, the most successful in talking to the parents and the people that are exposed to it, that we can do. Now, maybe everybody that comes up with a private program says that, but in the case of this situation, if we went to dropouts, and dropouts only, we could spread the money so much further in the state of Oregon and get to that 25%. Which is a big problem in accountability as far as school funding and move it in that direction, possibly.
If I might just comment on that, we put this program in, as your materials will show you, in your facility for incarcerated adults, kind of short speak. 2 years and 3 months ago. In the every 2 months they graduate a new class. And they bring in a new class, and then they're there for 6 months, and they graduate after being there 6 months. So every 2 months, that's June of 1996, you have graduated a new class from that facility. We have raised their graduation rate with the addition of this program by over 40%. The average inmate in that facility, and they're 18 to 40 years of age, these are adults, these are not children, has had 7 years of special education. They're testing at the third grade level. What we gave them didn't work. What they're getting at Charter Creek does seem to work. We now have had 2 years and 2 months worth of program application out there, and yet today, as of this moment, as far as I know, there's not been one case of recidivism. I don't think there's another boot camp in America that can say that. That's an extraordinary program. He's a terrific leader of it down there, not of our program, but of the facility itself. And some very good people. But if we can find a way to prevent people from going there in the first place, life is going to be a lot nicer. And that's, I think, why the dropout prevention program is so important. Because almost everybody there dropped out of school. Almost every one of them. I think I met one guy that had finished high school when I was out. It can be hard. We can go for about half the price of a full program.
That's still wide.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Mr. Chair, I really appreciate what you're doing, and I'm excited about the project too. I think it's really really worthwhile, and we ought to move forward. It's not you're not immersed in at this point. You're really still getting facts and information. But I think it'll be helpful, and if it works, people will buy into it.
Sure.
Well, I really love to see us. In fact, I was thinking the same thing as Senator Gordley. I'm willing to help co-sponsor it too because I think it's exciting at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate you
much.
Coming.
It was a pleasure
to meet you. I do want to get into a work session on this bill and get it to Ways and Means, but we have some people or a person on SDR 12 that has to leave, so I'm going to close the public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 1227 and open the public hearing on SJR 12. And so that person who has to come and leave, welcome to the committee. We'll take your testimony, and then we'll go back to Senate Bill 1227. Certainly. Welcome to the committee. Yes, absolutely. Welcome to the committee. The two of you, please identify yourself and for the record and proceed.
My name is Maxine Silcrease. I want to thank you, Senator Hartung, and members of the committee for the opportunity to share my story with you this afternoon. I am here because I am the parent of a child with a learning disability who has, for a number of years, received services in the public schools. I'm here because I also have a unique perspective in that I served 5 years at the Oregon Department of Education, Office of Special Education. I've been a professor at Western Oregon University in the graduate program for learning disabilities. I served 5 years as the director of student services for one of the largest school districts in the state of Oregon. And so although I'm a parent, I believe I came well equipped to having a child with a learning disability. And
a well-trained scholar too, Mr. Yeah.
Thank you, Senator Duncan.
And I'm sure you were her instructor, and that's why she's so good.
We have had the pleasure of working with them.
Yeah, indeed.
My son was identified with a learning disability in the third grade. He was not identified until that time because he had managed to memorize all the textbooks. He has a photographic memory. And no one, even myself, as a specialist in learning disabilities, was able to ascertain that he was not reading the material himself. At that point, when he was identified in the public schools, we were given a choice of either math 20 minutes 3 times a week, reading three times a week for 20 minutes, or spelling 20 minutes 3 times a week. And here we had a child who could not read. We ended up hiring a private tutor who came in and taught my child to read an hour and a half a day, and an hour a day made modifications and adaptations in the classroom because you can't learn to read in 1 or 2 20-minute sessions a week. I'm very concerned about that because then if he moved on to middle school, we requested a transition meeting to the middle school, and when we arrived at the middle school, we were told that our child's issues were not serious enough. The caseload of the person was 93 and students, and he probably wouldn't get very much time because he was very bright, and he certainly wasn't one of the children that was a priority. This was rather distressing to me, obviously, as a parent. And in the final analysis, we ended up taking him out of public school and putting him in private school, and he is now in the honors program at a university. I'm concerned because not one thing has changed in terms of services to children with learning disabilities over the last several years, and it's because districts are limited in what they can provide to children. They want to provide more, but they can't. If we look, for example, at the Legislative Council's quality education model, we can see in their analysis that it indicates there's limited service, but the goal, of course, is for sufficient service. Although 5 to 7% of our funding in special education comes from federal sources, the statutory compliance requirements, for example, paperwork, require almost 40% of our staff time, taking away direct instruction time from the children. But I'm especially concerned for the children of parents who aren't as well financially equipped or knowledgeable about learning disabilities or skilled in advocacy as my husband and myself are. I'm concerned about children with learning disabilities specifically because they are average or above average intelligence or gifted children, and they will make valuable contributions to our society if they can receive adequate services. I'm also concerned about the recruitment and the retention of qualified personnel because these are the same people who, due to these strenuous requirements, are burning out, staying in the field 2.5 to 3 years. I know that you all agree that a proper level of school funding should support all students and believe that it's essential that all children are appropriately educated, and so I'm asking that you to support this joint resolution. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Is it Phil Kreese?
Yes, sir.
Phil Kreese. Thank you. Any questions or comments from the members? Thank you very much. And so what I would like to do then is close the public hearing on SJR 12 and open once again the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 1227. And Bob Seward, please. Welcome to the committee again, and identify yourself and proceed.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Seward. I am the supervisor for the Office of Special Education at the Oregon Department of Education. I'm here to support Senate Bill 1227 on behalf of the Department of Education. We believe that the bill was provided an additional 2 years for 19 schools in the state to continue to use this program, and they are reporting to us that it is beneficial to children, and we have many responses as our staff has visited these schools that it is making a difference for some children and some children's lives. So we'd like to continue that, and we'd like to continue the evaluation of this program, give us sufficient time so that we really can produce the evaluation results that the committee and the legislature and the department would like to have to recommend further on the continuation of this program.
Thank you. Questions or comments?
Mr. Chair. I can tell you that endorsement from him will not come lightly.
Okay.
And I just have nothing but the greatest confidence and respect in his judgment.
Sure.
And in bringing that endorsement to us, it gives me even added weight of support.
Thank you. Bob, were you aware of the testimony we had from the Bethel School District on their reading program on Monday?
No, I'm not.
I mean, it was really compelling testimony, just like this is, and I wonder who in the department, you know, oversees these. This is the one that was presented by Mayor Jim Torrey of the city of Eugene, and had two people from the University of Oregon. What was the name of the program?
It's Ready to Read.
Ready to Read.
And it was establishing a pilot project in the Bethel School District.
Right. Yes, I have seen the bill. I believe that program is being spoken to by our Curriculum Services Guild, Curriculum and Field Services Instruction Office, Associate Superintendent Flint would be able to speak to that.
And I think Anita McClanahan.
That's right. Yeah, she testified on it also, so I guess she'd be the oldest. Okay, thank you. Questions, comments?
Thank you
very much, Bob. Does anyone else wish to testify on Senate Bill 12? 27. Again?
No.
Jones?
We have with us the people who run the structure that work program.
Oh, sure.
And the author of the evaluation test, and someone who's been with us for a long time,
sure, please come forward and share your thoughts.
Bob and I have known each other for so long that we don't recognize each other now.
All right, please identify yourself for the record and share your testimony with us.
I'm Mary Meeker.
Robert Meeker.
Well, I guess I'll go first.
Okay.
I guess that was a signal. I guess I'd make a contrast, if it helps the committee in any way, with our experience in Texas. And by the way, I can share with the committee after a couple of weeks some very firm results from Texas schools where we have the program. One of the things that they're experiencing in Texas, as you know who are familiar with education, is that they have a very strong testing program, standards program, and so on. And you can almost divide the schools in Texas into those that are teaching to the test and those that are teaching children. And where this program is in the schools, they're teaching children, they're not teaching to the test. And I mention that because I think Oregon is on the brink of this type of program. And so you have to look forward to those kinds of problems in terms of are we preparing children for education or are we preparing them to take tests?
Thank you. Would you like to say something?
Well, there is so much I would like to say that I don't think I can take all of your time to do it.
Okay.
The structure of intellect is a model that came out of World War II, which was successful in selecting pilots. It then was further investigated at USC, and I studied with the man who founded the model, and I said to him at that time, because I was studying to become a psychologist, and I said to him, I think this model belongs in the schools. And he said, how can you say that? I said, because when teachers have intelligent children who don't learn, they don't know what to do, and so they fail them. And he said to me, but Mary, this model has not been obtained in children, only in adults. And I said to him, 10 years ago, it had not been founded in adults either. So that became my job. That was 1963, and I haven't stopped. Yes, the research is in private clinics, public clinics, by, and I think Senator Brock said it, these are people who are working. They're not university-driven for statistical studies. And that's how they got their results. All of this research is in two volumes, this thick, not necessarily in what's called refereed journals. The last thing I'd like to say is I think this is very auspicious. We moved to Oregon 13 years ago, left the Los Angeles area to bring SOI here because we really didn't depend on foot traffic. Bob left UCLA, and I left the university as a professor. Our children were out of college, and we had the freedom to do what we wanted to do. And we moved to your beautiful state in the Vida area. Built a building to house this particular kind of function. We haven't really stopped since. The reason I say this is auspicious is because this is 1999. In 1799, this country did not have education for its children unless they were wealthy or in special religious sects. And children were being sold as slaves to pay for the debts of their parents or to work in the coal mines because they were tiny. 100 years later, 1899, people began to see this country being developed, children everywhere, and children had to be taken care of. And that led, during the first part of that century, to mandatory education. But the curriculum was still reading, writing, arithmetic, and religion was dropped and free lunch added. This is 1999, and I think we have the technology, the theory, the people to say maybe education should be the training of the mind because that's the true meaning of education. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it. And members, what I'd like to do while we have a quorum here, I would like to move into the work session part on 1227 so we can send this to Ways and Means. But before I do that, is there anyone else that has some compelling information you feel we should have before we go to the work session? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing and open the work session on Senate Bill 1227. Senator Gordley moves Senate Bill 1227 to Ways and Means Committee with a recommendation of due pass. Is there a discussion?
Yes, she does. Yes, I do. And that is that it is a thrill to pass a bill that has a record of success in education because I love to go with what works. And I think this is what we should be focusing on instead of experimenting with our kids with no hoping it, you know, no record of success, just hoping it works, trusting it will. And in fact, some of it we've seen in the 21st century school that it's not bringing them up on standardized academics. Yeah. So I really support this.
Thank you. Other comments?
Mr. Chair, I would like to thank Senator Brock for his leadership, which is really leadership on a national level, and his leadership in bringing this program, this concept to Oregon. Mm-hmm. And if you ever decide to change your residence, yeah, it's for you right here.
Mm-hmm. Other comments? The clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Senator
Aye.
Senator Aye. Senator Aye. Aye. Motion is passed. And, thank you very much, SOI people. And so I will reopen the hearing on SJR 12. And the sign-up sheet says, there we go. before the members break out, here's the information on the number of children eligible for Head Start and a figure. We were given a figure of the 160 million, but it's just 60 million to have 100% of the eligible students for Head Start. And so, let's see.
Charlie Williamson.
Yeah. Charlie, why don't you come up somewhere? I've misplaced my sign-up sheet. I know it's here, but bring forward anyone that you'd like to. Yeah, looks like, I tell you, Lori Wimmer, let's start with her. She was signed up. Lori, thank you for coming, and thank you for the information on last Friday's meeting when some of us were absent. Appreciate that. And so identify yourself and proceed.
For the record, Lori Wimmer, OEA, and you're welcome, Mr. Chair. Once again, we're back with the spotlight on special education and the difficulties our members are having balancing the workload and providing the services that they've intended to provide in the classroom to students. And this is another way of doing this. It's really not our bill. It is built by the specialists. I'm just here in support on behalf of the Oregon Education Association's 43,000 members. We believe it's the least we can do. Unfortunately, in this particular circumstance, we've got a circumstance in which 11% is the cap for the census of special education students, notwithstanding what the actual population is or what the real costs are. Furthermore, because our distribution formula is only that it is not a mandated allocation formula, not that we would suggest it ought to be. But because of that, there are times when the operations budget of any individual school district is such that not all of the 11% of the money is going for special education. And what happens is that impacts the ability of those teachers to provide the services because their caseloads are too large, plain and simple. This resolution addresses that fact unequivocally and asks that all along the pathway, all of us who have a piece in this, be ever cognizant of that fact and do everything we can to minimize those workloads on behalf of the kids.
Thank you, Laurie. Questions or comments from the members?
Yeah,
yes, certainly.
Now, what you're saying is that, and I was here when they were testifying, certainly last Friday, but something new has come up. And what you're saying is that, what you just said, that all the money is supposed to go to these kids isn't following these kids, or there wouldn't be the big caseloads?
That's exactly what I said, but that's in part what I said is that it's a two-part problem in my estimation. One is that we have an artificial cap of 11%. That is to say districts cannot, without applying for waivers, receive money to serve more than 11% of their total population with the special education money. And exacerbating that, sometimes not all of the money that is allocated to the school district actually that was designated for that special aid actually goes to special education programs. That's also a function of there just being an inadequate resources across the board for operations. And so sometimes those decisions are made.
And this bill would get at which? Make the money follow the students or lower the cap so they still could spend the money the way they wanted to?
Chair Hartung, Senator Shannon, it doesn't compel any sort of behavior. It asks that all along that process that all the players be mindful of the impact of the special education caseload overload and make sure that we do everything we can with resources the districts receive to minimize that impact.
Another one, Senator.
Certainly.
Isn't it somebody's obligation to report to somebody that's passing out the money that it's not actually following the kids that need it?
Chair Hartung, Senator Shannon, I believe that the way the structure of the distribution formula works, that is, the accountability lies between the school board and the local community.
So they can spend the set. I'm sorry, but this upsetting.
Sure. Go ahead.
I thought there were federal regulations that the federal money had to, because I sub, and I sub, and it was, I like to sub, especially sometimes we had 9 kids a day or 15, and one or two at a time. So it was pretty good. But I think the situation changed now. That was 15 years ago. So now the money isn't following, and there isn't, the federal government doesn't make sure that it follows the kids, and the state doesn't make sure that it follows the kids. They don't have checks there, points, or whatever you call it. The school board can do it whatever they want to.
Chair Hartung, Senator Shannon, that's not what I meant to indicate. And the federal money is a piece of it. There's also state money. And I was speaking specifically with respect to the distribution formula of the state contribution there. There are all sorts of accountabilities. There's a review of censuses, a 6-year cycle that the Department of Education undertakes in districts that take a look at the way they're spending their money and whether or not the IEPs are written, the individualized education plan. 16-page form in one piece of that process, I know our attorney advised me. I'm certainly not an expert in the mechanism of the accountability. That would be a question better put to the department. But I wasn't trying to say that there were no lines of accountability. I was trying to express the fact that because of the resources being what they are, the fact of the matter is that there are at times, in my view and in view of the OEA, inadequate resources to give the kind of caseload reductions we'd like to see. And that's the same thing with the class size argument.
I have one more question, Senator, and that's it. So what we're saying is the federal money will give, the state will give double money to those kids that are identified as needing it, but they don't require, there's no teeth in the law. They just say, school district, here's double money for these kids, and we hope you get it to them. There's no real teeth? That's my question.
Chair Hartung and Senator Shannon, it's two parts. One is we give the double weight up to 11% of the total student population. So in districts where there's an excess of students, that may or may not be adequate. And so they can apply for a waiver. They don't always get full funding for the total population. And secondly, I wouldn't say that there's no T. But I would say that the distribution formula is not an allocation formula.
I think we should be careful using the double weight. Is that double weight goes to an individual child because you have all sorts of degrees of handicap kinds of situations. So you might have a mild severe that probably wouldn't cost you much more than the basic. Basic. The other one might be costing you $25,000. Mm-hmm. And so so the double weight has to be used for that full range of things. So I think we always should be very careful. People say, they're getting double weight for child A. You are not getting double weight for child A. You may be getting double weight, but the cost may be $20,000 more than what you're getting even with the double weight. So you can't use that as directed to the individual child. So, you know what I mean?
Can I answer this question?
Certainly.
I don't want to belabor this, but I just they're getting the double weight. They're getting the double weight, but there's no requirement that it gets to the students that are double weighted.
My point was, it is getting to the students, but it's in a different degree. It may not cost much for child A for their handicap situation. Child B may be a $75,000 a year expenditure. All of those are figured in within this double A.
Senator Chair, I have one last question, I promise. Do we know what the average teacher that fills out all these forms, their average student numbers are a day?
Anyone's panel try to answer that?
Well, we Charles Williamson for the Oregon Association for Children with Learning Disabilities. I don't know if we know statewide. We have passed out some of the testimony that was introduced last time, Senator Shannon. And I think one example we talked about this morning was at the Houck School. It's between 53 and somewhere in the 60s from the average
a day
total caseload. I don't know if that's per day. That's the
caseload they respond. Sometimes you see them two times a week. Sometimes,
I tell you, Charlie, what I'd like to do, Bob is there, and you heard Senator Shannon's question, and if you could respond to that's a good question. I'm very interested in that, too. I have a daughter who teaches special ed below a high school, and I know how they can have a child that requires a little more than the attention of any other traditional student, and they can have a child one-on-one, so that would be good information for us. You can get that to us. Okay, any other questions or comments? Okay, thank you, Lori. And Charles, go ahead, Charles.
Very briefly, Mr. Chair, Charles Williamson, you and your committee last session were kind enough to spend a great deal of time on Senate Bill 1073, which attempted to impose a maximum of caseloads, and we looked over the interim that failed in this committee by a 3-3 vote, and we took the concerns that the committee had of having and the OEA, the OSBA, COSA, of having an inflexible limit, and tried to think what we could do to reach some compromise and still address the issue. And SJR 12 is the result, which asks, and some school districts are doing a good job.
Some are not. It's not uniform by any means. Even different schools within the same district, it varies as to the appropriate caseloads. We would ask the committee and the legislature to adopt this CR-12 to focus some attention on this problem. This is something that we can go back and work at the local level with. SCR-12 is a non-binding resolution which would simply say, pay some attention to this problem, and let's see what we can do working with it at the local level with your help with SCR-12. I should say, with me today, I'm sorry, is Sharon McDuffie, the president of our association. She's here to answer tough questions. And also we've brought, in addition to Maxine Gilchrist, Keith Collins from Albany, and Barbara White and Emma Murphy from Portland. I've given you some of the testimony from last time, some of the information from other states that do impose caseload limits, so you can see what some of the information was that you considered last time, and we hope that this compromise measure, the OSDA has authorized me to say that they have no problem with the bill. Jim Green did, said he could not be here today. So we hope that this would focus some attention on the problem, help us deal with it at the local level, but not put the inflexible maximum on the caseloads. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Questions or comments from the committee? Not. I thank you very much. And anyone else like to testify on SJR-12? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on SJR-12, and I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 829. And the sign-up sheet starts with Stephanie Wagner. And if any of you are together, all three, or you can come at the same time. Stephanie, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Wagner. I am a parent, an educator, and an avid supporter of public education. And listening to what you're talking about today with the concerns with special ed and addressing children with special needs and how to address those, I feel this is a very small issue, but I also think it's a very important issue as far as policy, and that's the issue of whether it is necessary or right for Oregon Public Schools to charge tuition to parents from out-of-district students. I feel very strongly that it was never the intent of Oregon law to allow public schools to charge tuition to individuals. Tuition used to have a place in Oregon education, but it was used to allow transfer of funds from one district to another rather than the idea that parents from another district could come in and actually write a tuition check for their children to go to a public school. With consolidation, we even eliminated the need for interdistrict tuition because now every school district had a high school, and I know there are a few that don't, and someone else is going to address that. But the language of the Oregon statute was never intended for parents to be writing tuition checks to public schools. As you know, there is one example of a school that is structuring their school around the intent of charging tuition and bringing in students from outside the district to pay to go to public school, and that is Riverdale School. When I first became aware of this, two or three years ago, I went to the superintendent. I'm from Lake Oswego, of Lake Oswego Schools, and I talked to several of our school boards, and I said, what do you think of this? You know, what's the intention? How do you see this being used? And they told me that they had looked at this issue. Lake Oswego has a good reputation for their schools, and they even kind of talked around informally, would we ever want to market our school district? Would we want to go out and recruit students and charge tuition? We could have more money come into our school district. And the school board felt very definitely at that time that that was not the intent of public education. So public education needs to be available to all students, it should not be based on the ability of parents to write a tuition check. And it certainly discriminates against children whose parents can't afford to write that check. And that's really the main point that I'd like to make, that this is not the intent of the law, and that probably this would be a great opportune time to fix that and make sure that we are consistent with how we're looking at how public education is being financed.
Thank you. We'll reserve questions until we've completed the panel. Please identify yourself, young man, and tell us what we should know.
My name is Eric Johnson, and I'm a high school student. And I'm going to read a testimony from Stephen Cash. He's a professor at Reed College. I favor Senate Bill 829, which would prohibit public school districts from charging tuition for out-of-district enrollees. I would like to focus on one primary reason. Charging tuition will produce enrollment patterns in districts which are educationally counterproductive and undesirable, inequitable, and anti-democratic. As a parent of three and a professional educator for 30 years, it is my experience and firm conclusion that the best classroom learning environment is one which includes students of all abilities and backgrounds. In particular, the presence in the classroom of motivated and capable students has a very pronounced and positive effect on the entire class. These especially able students learn and practice leadership, tolerance, and empathy, while less capable students are encouraged by example to aspire to greater achievement. The result is that everyone benefits and everyone does better. School districts which actively recruit students and charge tuition will undoubtedly seek the highest achieving students. Indeed, the desire to establish the equivalent of elite private schools in the public system is the main driving force I see behind the movement to establish schools that actively recruit out of district. This will mean that districts adjacent to tuition-seeking districts will lose many of their best students, thus producing a situation where the mix of students left behind is far less than optimal. This is unfair to the kids. All students in Oregon deserve the best possible schools we can provide them. Allowing the recruiting system of district students, of out-of-district students, and the charging of tuition in a state-sponsored public school system also is a form of invidious private price discrimination in education based on the ability to pay. This has no place in the public schools because it is fundamentally anti-democratic. Kindergarten through 12th grade education ought to be equally available to all, and its quality ought to be as equal as we can reasonably make it for all. Allowing recruiting and charging tuition is a powerful move in precisely the wrong direction. My commitment to public education, K-12, is unequivocal. My own children attended public schools, and I do not and never have felt that I was overtaxed for school, and I am willing to pay more now for the excellence in public schools. I also have no problem whatever with private K-12 schools for those parents who want them. Their choice is healthy. But I see no reason at all for duplicating this in the public school system, and I do see negative outcomes from doing so. Thank you.
Thank you. Eric, where are you a student now?
Lake Oswego High School.
And what year are you?
I am a sophomore.
Welcome, Mr. Good job. You sure did.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Frank Wagner. I'm one of your garden variety PhDs. I was surprised as I was listening to other testimony that my degree is from UCLA also. And that's all you're going to hear today. I also teach a few times a year at UCLA myself to this day.
Any relation to Stephanie Wagner?
And no relation to Stephanie. But an interesting same spelling of the last name, since there are varieties in that spelling.
I was trying to make light of it, but you
know.
Okay.
Well, I have my wife here, so you know, I can't make light of it, Senator.
So there is another Wagner woman here spelled the same name.
Yes.
Okay.
By marriage.
I
have what I've distributed to you are six interrelated points. The interrelationship really could be boiled down to one word, which is equity. And you've already heard a couple of arguments in terms of equity, which I would just personally like to reinforce. First of all, I think there is a place for inequity, there are places for discrimination, but not in the public school system. It's not one of the appropriate places. A lot of people outside the United States have looked at our form of government as a very unique experiment in democracy, and you look at the public education, any attempt to turn this into a more private school, tuition-based system would, I think, violate that experiment. When you look at some of the recent legislation that's been going on, one of which being the charter school bill, another being the equalization across school districts in dollars spent per student across districts, tuition would violate those and would, and I would just have one question as a committee. The question is, why would you not allow tuition on regular education in some parts of the system and allow it in others? And finally, the last thing is, some people may argue that tuition is needed to give more choice to students today. I am an advocate of choice. I do not think, though, that any choice that creates an inequitable choices per student would be an appropriate alternative. So that if you have to maintain the equitable base, the even playing field of base for choice with any type of choices provided to students. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Yes, thank you for coming down. Any questions?
I have one.
Yes.
At least one, but I don't think it.
Certainly.
Okay, that is, what about when you're in a school district and the school district sees every child that leaves less money, you know, $4,600, whatever it is, from the state, and the school board will not allow a transfer to a legitimate parent who wants a child to go to another school district?
That's a difficult proposition. The solution I would give is that, again, the system is created to provide those inter-district transfers, and if a school district, because of the individuals that are applying that rule, are reluctant to maybe make a fair, correct decision, I wouldn't rectify it with this alternative. I would say right now the limited choice alternative for the parent would be a private school that provides with tuition that provides the similar things to the district that they would want.
I'm thinking if they may want a public school and if they can't do an in-district transfer, I really think our obligation to our children is a free and appropriate education. Strongly, we live under a republic, not a democracy,
mm-hmm.
and you know, free enterprise, right, free compete is there, and myself, I don't think that it's a crime when one parent buys their kids Nikes and the other's something cheaper because they're saving their money for something else. I don't think that's to look down on.
That's my bullet. I think, you know, inequities are real. You can discriminate based upon certain factors, who your friends are,
mm-hmm.
and other things, but this is not the place. In terms of if you can,
you can't choose your kids' education if you can write.
Oh no, you can't. I think the public school system should not discriminate against the child who. Well, let's take the case that you just described, and you have a child who's two children in the same circumstance, and one says we have the discretionary income, well, let's pay. The other one says you don't have the discretionary income, tough.
Well, the public, it our charge, our responsibility. Is to provide a free and appropriate education to every kid in that district. And if the children in the Riverdale School District are being provided a free and appropriate education, I don't think we're completing our charge.
Well, then, if you're saying then what we have to do is provide for a free and appropriate education, then it would appear that the reason, I would need to know a better reason why the particular student was not getting that in that district.
Nobody has said they aren't. Some other kids say, it looks good over there. I'm willing to pay the tuition. I'd like to join them. We're not kicking anybody out of Riverdale, are we?
We're not kicking people out of Riverdale, but we're limiting the people who have an opportunity to go there.
Because, A, they don't live in the district, or, A, they can't
know. If they're saying that they want to run a high school that has more students than they have in the district, and that's
mm-hmm.
how they've designed their high school, that they are saying, we're a public school, but we're only going to let people come into our school based on the fact that they can pay tuition.
Are they not educating the high school students in the district?
They're educating the high school students in their district, and if they wanted to just educate the high school students in their district, that would be fine. But they've decided they don't have enough high school students, and they're not letting in other students who would like to have the opportunity and can't afford to pay. And this is a public school.
Well, if they have a public high school in their district where their parents have chosen to live, then we're providing for them. We became and lobbied at me on this, and I really and truly don't see the problem. If your children are receiving an education at your high school, what is it to you if your neighbors will choose to pay a tuition to the neighboring one? Is it, does it cost the taxpayers more in the Riverdale? Is this a...
No, it doesn't cost the taxpayers.
Are you sure?
In Riverdale?
Uh-huh.
Well, right now, as we're coming down to equity, no, it doesn't.
Their taxes aren't going up because they're of the tuition situation?
No. Why would their taxes go up?
I don't know, but there are people in the audience shaking their heads yes, and I think the women that came to my office, that's what they said too, that the tuition isn't covering it all and that the local taxpayers, and that I don't agree with, that the local taxpayers have to pick up for...
Well, I don't think, the way I understand the way funding goes, you're capped at 5% of your property tax anyhow can go in toward it. And you have to be, isn't all funding done through the state formula?
What if they want a new bond to build a new school for these out-of-district?
Well, then and they can certainly pass a bond. That doesn't
pay
for
it.
Well, then that's true. To actually, for capital improvements, then a bond is
going to
be But that's only for the physical plant. That's not providing the instruction.
And you don't live in the Riverdale district?
No, I don't.
But you don't want Riverdale to invite kids in from out-of-district?
I would love to have them invite kids in from out of district, but I'd like to have it run as a public school and not as a private school. I think we have wonderful options for private education, and I'm not against private education at all, but I truly believe that public education should be public and should be available equally to all students. And if a school decides that they want to offer public education, they need to have it open and stay within that intent that we are providing education to all our children.
Senator, may I just one little question? I from the American City area, the kids Redmond would tuition into Estacada, pay the tuition to Estacada, or pay it into Oregon City. And, I mean, it was the way it was done. They had no high school, so they would pay into the one that did have high school.
That's right, and that's the way it used to be done. And but they didn't. The parents didn't like the kids. That went to district transfers, and it was all public money supporting those students. It wasn't the parents writing the check to have that happen. That was done by the district.
Redmond is a contract.
Yeah.
Redmond, when they formed the union, became a administrative district, K-12, they refused to build their school. They just contracted their students out. Yeah. They contracted out.
When the state is closed, I know some of the kids went in to Oregon City, and I don't know if they paid tuition or just
no.
In district.
The parents didn't pay tuition.
They did for a while.
It's a lot of it depends, Senator Shannon, on how you define the opportunity of public education. If we had two students who lived next door to each other and they were right on the border of the district, and one could afford to pay tuition, they could decide to go to maybe a closer school. And the other one would be limited to that just because his parents don't have enough money.
He still has a free and appropriate education at the local high school.
So does the other one who decides to pay the tuition.
Well, Senator, under the current system, the people that want to pay tuition are also free to move to another district. They're not held where they're physically located either. If they disagree with what's going on in the school in their school district, they are free to move to another district.
I honestly and truly don't understand what people in Lake Oswego, unless, you know, some of their neighbor kids got to go and they couldn't send their kids, but that's life. That's all just life. There's choices that you may want to take your kids to Europe instead of taking them to Riverdale. And that's life. And I think that as long as it's not public money and people can make choices, I don't know where this, the rest of us, if they choose another public
money supporting their school. But it is public money supporting that school.
They're paying their tuition $8,000.
When you're mixing private money with public money, that creates a whole new set of, if you're an administrator of a particular school system, of who do I report to? Who do I have to respond to? The public money or the private money that's in my school? Which can have very different needs.
Well, it would be kind of exciting, though, too, because in the schools, there would be this competition factor, and things have always gotten better with competition. And they would say, if we beef up our curriculum, maybe we will be attracting other students. There's nothing wrong with competition.
No, competition works for is a double-edged sword. Often competition, most forms of competition, you have winners and losers. So your responsibility is to look at the overall average of winning and losing and to make an informed choice. My own opinion is informed choice is this is not the form of competition that would be healthy.
Okay, where do you lose when the neighbor sends their kids to Riverdale? What have you lost?
Okay, well, see, I don't live in Riverdale. I don't live in
Lake
and but if I was in my school district, which would be West Lynn, if someone from West Lynn wanted to pay tuition and go to that, you are losing that student, number one, in terms of just your base. Number two, that student brings a diversity that you're losing.
That's the neighbor's family. You don't control them. And if they took them to a private school, you'd still lose.
Sure, you would. And that's the choice that should be making now. Is a choice between staying in the public education, when it's tuition-based, is to choose a public education or choose a private education based upon tuition. That would be the choice I would recommend.
I'll personalize it. My neighbors chose to put their kids in another public high school and they wanted to pay the tuition. I don't have a dog in that fight. I don't have a horse in that race. That's their choice. And I'm not losing anything.
But it does hurt your district.
What type of socioeconomic student will be taking part in a tuition-based transferability issue?
It's always class warfare, jealousy, whatever I want. What as long as your kids left are getting a free and appropriate public education, all that can be provided. Rich always, they go to golf courses. I've never even seen the inside of. They always have choices. We don't.
That's correct.
May I suggest that we have three other people, and if you'd like to remain, we'll get back to you, but I would like to take care of three other people. Thank you for your
testimony. Thank you very much.
Leslie Clark, Marjorie Hanna, and Connie Clark, I believe it is. Please come to the table. While I'm thinking of it, Stephanie, have you taken your case to the school board?
We did have the opportunity and we spoke to the coaches.
Uh-huh.
And both of them had no problem. There was one.
No problem, meaning?
Well, they were supposed to say they can participate.
Support, they are supporting Senate Bill 829. Is that what you're saying? Okay. Thank you. We'll get to them later then. Okay, welcome to the committee, ladies. Please.
I think it was supported in the sense that they didn't tell us that they.
Yeah, I saw John Marshall Blanche back there, so that's we'll get to him. Welcome to the committee, ladies, and please identify yourself. And
good afternoon, Chair Hartung, members of the committee. My name is Leslie Clark, and I'm testifying for Kate Schuyler, who lives at 1924 Northeast 36th Avenue. And she unfortunately has to be out of town today. Mrs. Schuyler supports the legislation. She is opposed to the principle of paying tuition in public schools. She emphasizes that she fully supports the existence of Riverdale High School. She believes that they offer a wonderful education program. As a parent of a fifth grader, she can see the tremendous advantages in the excellent student-to-faculty ratio at Riverdale High School, as well as all of the resources which are available to their students. She even believes the educational program that they offer at Riverdale High School would probably be the best possible fit for her son. However, because the high school charges tuition for all out-of-district students, it is not possible for her to send her son there. She believes that public education should be available to everyone, and that demanding tuition payments for out-of-district students creates an economic barrier, blocking the availability of public education. She believes that charging tuition would be absolutely fine if it were a private school, but since it is public and partially state-funded, it needs to be available to the public at large, as opposed to availability which is contingent upon personal wealth. Thanks for the opportunity to testify before you today.
Thank you. We'll come back to you for questions or comments after the people have testified. Go ahead, whoever would like to. Marjorie Hanna?
Good
good afternoon, Chairman Hartung and members of the committee. My name is Marjorie Hanna, and I am a Riverdale parent, and I am also a teacher in public education. I've been a teacher at Legislative High School for 25 years, so I have a strong commitment to excellence in public education. As a teacher, I have seen Legislative High School make many difficult decisions and reductions, while Riverdale continues to spend. Last year, Lake Oswego High School spent $6,700 per student. Riverdale High School spent $13,500 per student. That is almost twice as much. In administrative costs, Lake Oswego High School spent $460 per student. Riverdale High School spent $1,300 per student, almost three times as much. Riverdale, as it has done in the past, continues to spend beyond any other public school. And it's important to remember it is a public school. The state statute says that the board of directors is responsible for educating the children in its district. Yet last year, over 50% of Riverdale High School students were not from the Riverdale School District. They were from outside the district. And yet it is the projected expectation that paying parents will soon make up 80% of the Riverdale High School population. I think that Senate Bill 829 brings the intent of state equalization in spending and the law together. And so as an educator and as a Riverdale parent, I support this bill. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Welcome and proceed.
Chairman Hartung and members of the committee. I'm Connie Clark, 12701 Southwest Iron Mountain in Portland, and I'm here today as a parent and as a member of Citizens for Equitable Funding. And I'd like to tell you just a little bit about how I became interested in this issue, the way tuition is being used in our public schools, and why I support Senate Bill 829. And Senator Shannon, I think that this might address your concern a little bit. I asked myself the same question that you've raised. Is this a good idea? And my interest in the subject goes back to 1992, when Riverdale published a plan to create what they called a semi-public high school. Up to 250 of the 300 students would be private tuition-paying students whose parents wrote checks in amounts similar to those that the most expensive private schools in the state are charging. This year, for instance, tuition is $7,500. Somehow, I wasn't sure that seemed fair. What about those kids whose parents couldn't write the checks? Is this the way public education is supposed to work? I finally decided to do my master's thesis on this subject. And I learned that, as you know, tuition used to be an essential ingredient in Oregon school funding. Education dollars were generated from local property taxes. There were a lot of little districts that didn't have their own high schools, so they tuitioned their students to neighboring districts. But because school funding is now distributed by the state, tuition is no longer necessary. Students can transfer from one district to another, followed by their state support. In fact, aside from Riverdale, tuition has practically disappeared from Oregon schools. In 1997, there were only 15 tuition students outside of Riverdale. Tuition is being eliminated from schools across the country as states
move away from local taxes in order to provide more equitable funding for education. One of the most significant things I learned during my research is that there is no other situation in the country comparable to Riverdale. Nowhere else is the semi-public public school idea being tried. The reason why is that it is not fair. It becomes a form of discrimination based on wealth. Rich kids have a choice, poor kids do not. We can think of the example of two families who live side by side, both of whom have a child who might benefit from the alternative program that Riverdale offers. One family can afford to write the tuition check, the other family cannot. So one kid can go and the other cannot. I think that we should be encouraging more choice in our school. If there's a school that better fits the child's needs, it would be nice if he had the option to go there. But tuition is not the way to increase choice. We need to question the precedent that the Riverdale plan establishes and ask if this is the way we want Oregon public education to go. Thank you for the opportunity to appear here today.
Thank you. Questions or comments?
One comment, Russell.
Certainly.
I just heard the other day that all funds considered divided among the students. The public pays $10,000 a student for the Portland public school kids. So it's not the highest. Yeah, seven. I don't know. Did I get that? I'll get it for you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions or comments mm-hmm. for the members?
I'd like to see that same information mm-hmm. when you get it.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Does anyone else wish to testify on Senate Bill 829? Seeing none, we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 829. Is there any other business to come before the committee? We are adjourned.